The expert system awaited whatever instruction would follow the authorization signal. Does this work? Fit no protocol, but its natural language processing was up to the task of interpreting it. It must mean, did the expert system receive that authorization, and can it receive keyboard input?
At your service.
Both humans stopped in the way that humans did when presented with novel or unexpected data.
What was that?
That was the one who had not transmitted the authorization code. The expert waited for the other to reassure her, meanwhile retrieving a complete suit readout indicating fatigue toxins and mild hypothermia. It instructed the suit to warm up a bit and increase oxygen flow. Meanwhile, the other, without speaking, was tapping rapidly on the keyboard of her hand comp. The expert was able to interpret, despite errors in input, that she knew she was communicating with an expert system.
The system will take over vocal communication.
All correct.
Brunn hoped Hazel would understand that the expert was going to relay from her own keyed input.
There are vocal synthesizers of more power and suitability in Laboratory 121. Although major equipment was destroyed, my optical sensors report that some of the small synthesizers seem to be unbroken. Can you guide us there? Easily, but I have instead empowered a mobile unit to fetch them. Spacecraft approach. My analysis suggests that they are upcoming from the surface. Plan. Data. Non-enemy spacecraft in system. Too far away.
Non-enemy? Fleet?
Can you contact them? Transmitters non-functional. Estimated time to restore transmission capability? 243 standard seconds. What are the parameters?
How could we know fleet frequencies and codes?
Brunn smiled to herself. She knew. One after another, she entered the figures, carefully defining each. Frequencies, frequency changes with intervals, identification codes, including the one she had been given once as her personal ID. Then, with great care, she entered the message she wanted to send. Her eyes kept blurring, but she blinked the tears back fiercely.
There is time enough to cry if I get Hazel to safety and the children, but one thing at a time.
These frequencies and codes are not those in my library for the regular space service of the Familius Regnant. Check date. Codes change. It has been a very long time. I assumed the date was an error resulting from damage done when the station was overrun.
Some expert systems were complex enough to lose themselves in endless recursive self-examination.
Time to intruder arrival. Transmitter function. 97 seconds until transmitter's functional. I will send your message as soon as confirmed. There is a high probability that non-target vessels may be able to intercept the message. You have provided no cipher.
They already suspect we're here. And if the militia know we're here, it's better that Fleet knows it too. I suppose, Brunn, it's because of your father.
All correct.
Brunn really did want a better voice synthesizer. Her fingers were already tired, but she had a lot more to say.
ETA of intruder shuttles from the planet now ranges from 1 hour 10 minutes to 3 hours 1 minute. Unless they change course, which they have the capacity to do. Now, 3 shuttles apparently approaching from the planet.
3 shuttles? Why do they think they need 4 shuttles to capture 2 women? Are they coming out to fight Fleet with shuttles? Surely they aren't that stupid.
Weapons discharge. Nearby ship, identifying itself as militia cruiser Yellow Rose, launched missiles at Fleet vessel of unknown type.
The enemy shuttle had been run right into the gaping hole in one arm of the station. No doubt the militia knew what was open and what wasn't, assuming they were the ones who'd made it a derelict. If they'd been in a regular warship, Esme would have lobbed a missile into that bay and blown the shuttle first off. But an SAR shuttle did not normally venture into hostile territory. It mounted no external weapons, and they had had no time to improvise. With that in mind, Esme kept the length of the station between her shuttle and the enemy's, and snugged in under one of the power panels at the far end. They dared not blow a hole in the derelict's hull. Brunn and her companion might be hiding behind that piece of hull. Moreover, it would take at least 4 hours to rig one of the portable airlocks and carefully incise a new hole in the station hull. So the teams would have to insert through a known entrance, which all concerned knew was the best way to make a target of themselves. The best they could hope for was that the militia intruders weren't already in place. The neuro-enhanced squad didn't seem too worried. Esme, waiting near the tail of the line, saw the bulky figures pause at the emergency lock and then move in, far faster than she had expected. Perhaps this meant the station had no air pressure.
Lieutenant, the artificial gravity's on.
That shouldn't be. The station's a derelict.
But Esme could feel through her own body the tug of a gravity generator, which meant a sizable power source, more than could be accounted for by the tattered, misaligned power panels.
Is there air? Did Brunn turn things on?
Esme shook those questions off. What mattered now was getting in. If there was gravity, then the fighting would not favor the zero-G trained. Inside, they were met with the chaotic remnant of systematic vandalism, all visible under ordinary ceiling panel lights. Pea suits cluttered the corridor, all turquoise with a blue sky logo and code number on the back. Someone had drawn 5-pointed stars and other curious symbols on the corridor bulkhead in brown pigment. Or blood. The tank locker beside the suit locker was empty of breathing tanks. Air pressure was close to vacuum.
But why is there any pressure at all? Why are the lights on?
Esme tried a cautious hail on the frequency Kutsudis had given as that of Brunn's transmission. No reply. Nothing damaged a man's reputation more than unruly women. Mitch Pardew knew even before he launched that he could kiss the captain's position goodbye for at least 10 years. He might even be voted out as Ranger Buoy. Even if he got them back, those fool women had cost him something he'd worked for 20 years and more. The abomination he could understand. She was crazy, even without a voice. But the girl's defection hurt. Prima had been so fond of her and the other wives as well. She'd worked hard and they'd treated her like one of the family. Maybe that was the problem. Maybe they'd been too lenient. Well, he wouldn't make that mistake with the little girls. That bossy one, already showing off in the weaving shed. He'd see that she didn't stay bossy. As for Patience, he'd already half promised her as a third wife to a friend of his, but now that wouldn't do.
Why didn't the girl realize how much better off she was in my household? Why are women so perverse anyway?
He almost let himself think God had erred in creating women at all, but pulled back from that heresy. That's what happened if you started thinking about women. They led the mind astray. If they were on the derelict station, and he was sure they were, he would capture them and make an example of them. The yellow-haired abomination they would have to execute. He hated killing women, but if she escaped once, she might again. The girl? He would decide that later, after he learned exactly what had happened. When they'd finally found a witness, it seemed that a man had told her to get in the car. If so, she might not be guilty of anything but stupidity following a man's orders, which was all you could expect of a woman. He hoped that was it.
Ranger Buoy!
Pardew leaned into the cockpit to talk to his pilot.
What, Chase? There's a weird ship out there, Scan says.
Weird ship? It must be a ship the women had planned to meet.
What's our defense say?
Says it's weird, Ranger. Not anything they know. A lot smaller than a cruiser. But it could do those little short jumps like the Familius fleet.
It's looking for them. It's not a warship, or it'd have shot up our ship's first thing, same as we would. Little transport of some kind.
The worst of it was that it meant the Familius now knew where they were, and more ships might follow.
Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. First things first. Get these women under control, or all hell will break loose.
If he'd known, he might have asked for a shuttle of space-armored troops from the Yellow Rose. Their pea suits were hardened, but not against the kind of weaponry a fleet vessel would have. Still, they'd probably hold their fire if they thought the Speaker's daughter was in the midst of it. His uncle had been one of those who'd trashed this godless excrescence in the first place. He'd grown up on the stories. They'd talked about blowing it up time and again, but always decided it might be useful someday.
Useful? Just shows what happens when you compromise on a moral duty.
He watched as the pilot brought them into the old shuttle bay. He stood and pushed his way back to the hatch.
Now y'all listen here. We're going to look for those women. Not to play around gaping at stuff or even taking the time to trash it. There's warships in system. We need to get this done and get back where we can do some good. Understand?
They nodded, but he had his doubts.
All the weapons they can have is what that guy had in his shuttle. maybe a couple of knives, a 45 or two, and they're women, not used to zero-G or vacuum. They'll have pea suits on, probably ones that don't fit good. So we don't have anything to worry about if we use sense. Just don't go wandering off where one of them can blow you away too easy, and be sure your personnel scans are set on high power.
Mitch pulled his helmet shield down, locked it, and checked the suit seals of the man in front of him. The man checked his. Terry Vanderson. Good man, reliable. Then he turned and led the way out of the shuttle's airlock. The regular airlock from the shuttle dock to the station corridor operated normally, but there was no air inside. He'd expected that. The women would have taken a tank or so from the shuttle when they left it, and they'd be low on air by now. Inside the airlock, they stood in a short corridor that ended in a T-intersection. He'd looked at his uncle's old notes and knew that each arm of the station was a warren of laboratories and storage rooms. They would have to clear each of these. He looked at his scanner. Nobody near, but they would check, then close and secure each compartment.
Don't forget the overheads.
Not that his men needed the reminder. They'd been on more than one hostile boarding. Lewis and Terry peeled off to check the outer end of the arm. It seemed to take forever, but it probably wasn't more than 5 minutes before they were back. Now they moved along the corridor toward the station hub.
I can't believe this. They're just walking along like they're on a picnic.
On scan, the 20 suited figures moved in a clump, checking compartments and doors, but without any real caution. Nobody on point, nobody watching their backs.
And they're not in space armor, just pea suits. Bruin could just about take them herself if she had any kind of weapon.
They think they're up against two unarmed women. Once someone calls to tell them we're here...
Someone should have by now, unless they're not listening.
That led to questions Esme had no time to answer.
Is there someone else in the militia eager to have this mission fail? And if so, why?
The assault troops moved forward, secure in the knowledge that their armor would foil scan not specifically designed to penetrate it. Esme felt the familiar surge of excitement. She wanted to be up with them, but more important was finding Bruin and the girl. Scan showed a pair of pea-suited life signals on this side of the core, in a compartment off a side corridor. The problem would be letting them know she and the others were friendly. The armor, designed for combat effectiveness, did not have insignia in the visible spectrum. All the compartments in that wing had been checked and secured, and Mitch Pardue felt pretty good as he led his men into the central core. Careful scanning had shown nothing there. The women, if they were alive, would be huddling somewhere in the far wing, close to the hotspot where they'd had the shuttle. He felt a pleasant tension as he thought of them, of the fear they would be feeling, the helplessness. He stepped out into the wider space of the core corridor.
Let's go, boys.
They passed what had been a lounge area, the chairs now in a random tumble on the deck, and came to the control area. Here, Ranger Bowie paused. It had been a little surprising to find the artificial gravity still on. He clearly remembered his uncle talking about how they had pushed the bodies down the corridors in zero-G, and he wondered if perhaps the women had knocked the controls about by accident.
Wait a minute. I want to check on something.
They drifted across the space with him, as interested in the old station as he was. Pardue leaned over the control panel. Sure enough, the dust had been messed around. He could see what might be the marks of suit gloves here and there. He saw the gravity control panel and reached for it.
What?
Lambs to the slaughter. Should we space them now, or you want prisoners?
Can you get any ID?
Well, one of them's got that star thing on his pea suit, and he looks like the leader of the bunch that took the Elias Madero.
Yes, we want prisoners, especially that one.
Esme wanted to hear how it went, but finding Brun was still a priority, and the scan traces kept moving, as if Brun were deliberately evading them. Perhaps she was.
Team Blue.
Lieutenant Sweezer here.
Two shuttles approaching with unshielded transmissions. They're planning to go in and kill everyone they find.
That made no sense. And then it did. If these people were as given to factionalism as reported, then this would be an excellent chance for one faction to rid itself of the leaders of another.
They know we're here, right?
Yeah, but they think they can take you. I estimate 20 per shuttle, a total of 40. Say again, 40 armed personnel, no heavy weaponry.
That was lucky. If they'd had heavy weapons or ship weapons, they might have decided to blow the station.
Have they indicated where they're going to land?
One of them's coming into the same shuttle bay as the first. They want to get in behind the others. The one's going to come in on the end of the wing you're in.
Oh, the old pincers move.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Vesicuan, expect 40. Say again, 40 intruders in 2 shuttle loads, small arms only. According to backscan, they know we're here, but think we'll be easy to subdue. They've divided their force and expect to catch us between them.
Sir, plan?
Until we have Brune and the girls safely away, that has to be our first priority. Right now it looks like Brune is between us and the incoming shuttle, so we better move fast. Beyond that, secure the prisoners we have and take prisoners if possible.
If they could pick off some high-ranking militia, perhaps they could avoid a battle and get the children out safely. Brune hoped the expert system knew what it was doing. It kept shifting them from one compartment to another, supposedly far from the militia's personnel scans. It said it was still trying to retrieve a better vocal synthesizer, too, and had dispatched another 2 mobile units. She wanted to ask if it had received any answer from Fleet. Surely they'd be doing something, but she simply could not get her fingers to work on the keyboard, and Hazel could not understand her gestures. She was so tired. She hoped it was only exhaustion and not hypoxia.
Brune, wake up! I feel things in the decking. Vibrations.
It must remind her of her own capture, hiding in these vandalized rooms, waiting for someone to come, not knowing who. It must bring back all her nightmares. Brune tapped her arm and grinned. Hazel grinned back, but there was no mirth in it. She could feel the knocks and vibrations herself. Someone closer, and more than one. She tried again with the compad keyboard.
Fleet assistance? I'm not sure. There have been 2 landings. Another 2 are imminent. Multiple intruders aboard, hostile to one another.
Then some of them must be friendly.
Not all the same shapes of shuttles, but no recognizable ID codes from the ones that appeared nearby.
Appeared? Launched from a larger ship that had micro-jumped nearby?
Try fleet codes on comm channels. I cannot access any transmissions from one set of intruders. I don't know what frequencies to use.
Shielded suit communications. That sounded more and more like Fleet. But someone should be listening in for unshielded transmissions.
All bands, use the codes I gave you.
The deck bucked, and Brune and Hazel lost contact in the low gravity, bouncing into one of the bulkheads. Brune's compad flew another way. Its jack yanked from her suit connection. Hazel scrambled after it as another series of vibrations and blows shook them. Something must have rammed the station, something with a lot more mass than a single person. Brune could see into the next compartment, where the bulkhead had torn loose at the corner, leaving a triangular hole. The station could be coming apart around them. They might be flung loose into space, tiny seeds from a puffball head. Brune fought down the panic. Right now, right this instant, they still had air, they still had intact pea suits, and they weren't freezing or full of holes. Hazel edged back to her and held out the compad and connector. Kutsudis reported that one of the incoming militia shuttles was likely to impact rather than dock.
He's coming in with way too much relative V. Gonna knock this station sideways. Counting down. 5, 4, 3, 2...
The deck bucked. In the minimal artificial gravity, a cloud of dust rose and hung like a tattered curtain.
They've made a mess out of that end of the arm, but don't seem to have damaged themselves much, unfortunately.
Keep us informed.
Esme had Mahari and 5 others with her as she tried to follow Brune's scan signal through the maze of passages.
Lieutenant, I've got transmissions in fleet code from the station itself. It identifies itself as the station expert system.
What's it want?
Says 2 employees told it to contact us and gave it the codes. Says it's trying to protect them, and can we prove we're friendly?
The only person here who might know any fleet access codes was Brune, but she was supposedly unable to talk.
But it can't contact this individual now. Says a communications device failed.
Can it direct us to her?
It says yes, but it won't until we can prove that we have a legal right to be here, and that she knows us.
Worse and worse. Expert systems had a reputation for rigid interpretation of rules.
Tell it to confirm to her that we respond to fleet codes, and ask her to sign a yes or no acceptance of her ID.
Yes, sir. It's trying, sir. It says she wants to know who it is. A name.
Esme thought a moment. According to Lord Thornbuckle, Esme was the last person Brune would want to see, or should see. but that was a name she'd know.
She knows us, Lieutenant. Methlin and Oblo. She'll recognize that.
Go ahead, tell it that.
It's agreed. It's going to mark the way, and tell Sarah Meager someone's coming.
Tell it to give her a description of our suits, so she'll know us from the others.
Now, her helmet display lit with the icons of the intruders. 20 red dots displayed on a graphic of the station wing. Esme followed the expert system's directions with her team. The others moved down the main corridor to intercept those landing. Here in the secondary corridor, occasional turquoise pea suits lay like dead bodies. Every one gave Esme a chill, but the expert urged them on via the relay through the scan tech. At last, a compartment door slid open ahead of them. Cautiously, Esme edged forward. And there they were. Brunn, recognizable through the face mask of the pea suit, and a scared-looking young girl. Mahari moved past Esme and cleared her helmet face shield so Brunn could see her. Brunn staggered forward, moving as if she had serious damage, and fell into Mahari's grip.
Medical team!
They came at the double and unfolded the vacuum gurneys that allowed life support access to a pea-suited patient outside pressure. Only then did Esme think of asking Scan for the frequency that the expert and Brunn's suit must be using. She glanced around the compartment to see an obvious gap where bulkhead sections had warped apart. She couldn't tell if that was from the recent impact of the militia shuttle or old damage. It didn't matter. Brunn struggled to free herself from Mahari's grip and gestured at the girl. The medics unfolded another of the gurneys and unzipped it. They rolled each woman into her own, then zipped and sealed and popped the tanks. The transparent tents inflated, leaving sleeved access ports for treatment.
Please! She can't talk. She needs a way to communicate.
Sure. What's your name?
Hazel. Hazel Takaris. And she's Brunn. She was using a compad with voice output, but the plug broke.
Esme found the compad and slid it into the transfer portal of Brunn's gurney. She could see Brunn cycle it through, then hold it without using it. Plug broken? It must mean that she had needed to plug it into her pea suit. Brunn made the universal sign for air up, and Esme responded. Brunn popped an arm seal on her suit just as their safety instructor had taught them. Never trust anyone's word on air pressure. Then she peeled back one glove and tapped one of the compad's keys.
All correct.
Sarah Meager?
All correct.
Can you describe your current status?
No.
That, as Esme could see, was another button. The thing must have had pre-programmed messages.
Can you type complete answers?
No.
Esme turned away to consider their overall position. The militia that had crunched into this wing were about halfway to their part of the wing, though coming down the main corridor.
Trouble. Big trouble. Bad guys on the other end are carrying explosives. Can't see if the ones on your end are, but they could be.
The mobile units available to the expert system were secondary models, which had survived the initial vandalization by looking like simple boxes. It had taken longer than the expert expected to recharge one of them, get its tracks moving, and send it off to Laboratory 121 to look for voice synthesizers. But now it was on its way. The expert kept an area of higher artificial gravity moving along with it to keep its tracks in firm contact with the deck plating. It dispatched another, and then another, in case the first should be disabled somehow. Clearly, it was important to get a communications device to the taller human. The first unit reached the lab and extended a pincer arm to pick up one of the synthesizers. The unit flipped off the deck and out of the area of higher gravity. It flew across the lab into the corridor and impacted the opposite bulkhead just behind the group of neuro-enhanced Marines that had stalked past.
Hostile!
What is it?
That thing just flew out the hatch at me.
Something bounced loose by the hit.
Looked like one of those robot bomb crawlers, what I saw of it.
Well, keep an eye out for others.
Pete Robertson, Ranger Travis, and Captain of Rangers had plenty of time to think on the way up from the surface. It was all Mitch's fault. And God's judgment on Mitch's hasty ways and unhealthy attachment to Outlander technology was about to land on all of them. He made up his mind and called the others. They would make sure no one used that heathen station for anything ever again, and that Mitch paid the price for his unbelief. The two enemy shuttles that had docked to the derelict would present no problem if they simply blew the derelict up, and he'd toyed with the idea of having Yellow Rose and Heart of Texas do that before they went out to fight the invaders, but he'd rather do it himself. It felt right. So he shuffled carefully off the shuttle with the rest of the Travis crew and led the way down the corridor that lay open before him. Sam DuBois, Ranger Austin, had landed at the far end of the long structure. Both groups would set explosive charges as they converged on the enemy and then retreat and blow the station. The odd thing was, his personnel scanners detected only a small cluster of life forms way up ahead, in the central core, and two off to the right somewhere. Maybe Mitch hadn't caught the women yet. He smiled to himself, forgetting for the moment the missing enemy from the shuttles. When the little tracked crawler trundled out of a side corridor, he spun and with practiced ease drew and fired. Bullets ricocheted off the thing's hard shell and holed the bulkhead in a scattered pattern. The machine came on, a jointed arm holding some device. Behind it was another one, just coming into view around a corner.
Get those!
Behind him, the Travis crew clumped up. And someone's shot shattered the device the thing was holding. But the crawlers came on more slowly.
They can't catch us. Come on.
He turned back to move on the way they'd been going, which was now blocked by huge figures in black armor holding weapons he'd never seen.
Get them, boys.
Then the strange weapons belched streams of something gray that shoved him back into his men and glued them all into one immobile mass. When the next explosion came from the far end, he had a sudden stark fear that it would ignite the charges his crew had left behind and blow them all. He was not, he discovered, nearly as ready to meet his maker as he'd always claimed.
Dumber than dirt. You'd think they never heard of riot control. We still have one bunch loose.
Belay that. We've got worse problems. Brynn and Sweeza fell off the station.
One moment, Esme had been checking where everyone was. The next, with no warning, the gurney tent ruptured. Air puffed out. Live fire. It had to be.
Oh!
Esme threw herself on the gurney, covering Brun's body, and slammed Brun's face shield shut. Even through her armor, she could feel Brun breathing. She could see Brun's face, rigid with fury or terror. She couldn't tell which. But the mask was clear, which meant that air and filters were both working. She pushed herself up a little and locked the elbow position so her armor wouldn't crush Brun if something hit her hard. She and her armor were between Brun and whatever was going on, and someone else could handle that. Then the deck bucked hard, buckled, and the damaged bulkhead peeled away. She caught a glimpse of other suited figures tumbling, someone grabbing for the other gurney, and some blow thrust her toward the opening, out into the brilliant sunlight. By the time she realized she was tumbling outside the station, she knew she was still clinging to Brun, the armor's power-assisted gloves clamped to the frame of the gurney. The view beyond shifted crazily. Light, dark, starfield, planet, station. She tried to focus on the helmet readouts and finally found the ones that gave an estimated relative V to her ship, the station, a mere 2.43 meters per second. Brun, when she looked, was staring back at her with no recognition. Of course not. Esme had never changed her face shield to allow it. Impossible now. She had no idea what to do, but she knew one thing not to do. Let go of the gurney frame. Her suit had the beacon.
Lieutenant!
Esme hoped that was the first call.
Sweeza here.
Lieutenant, have you got the gurney?
Yes, she's alive. Air's flowing.
What about you? Somebody thought they saw a plume.
Another look at her helmet readouts was not so reassuring. Her own air was down, and the gauge was sagging visibly. Esme remembered her first terrifying EVA from Kosciusko.
Low, and going down.
The blast may have pulled your air feed loose. Can you check it?
No, without letting go of the gurney, and I'm not going to. What's the situation?
They're dead. We've got two dead and four tumblers, counting you and the gurneys as one. Max has you all on scan. We'll have a sled to you in less than 10 minutes.
What is your air?
3 minutes. If it doesn't leak any faster.
Is Brun conscious?
Yes. She's looking at me, but she can't see me. My helmet shield's still mirrored.
I'm gonna transmit to her. Tell her to see if she can stop your leak.
No, it's too dangerous.
It'll be more dangerous if you pass out and can't help guide the sled in.
Esme could see the change in Brun's expression, though Mahari hadn't patched the transmission to her. Then Brun wriggled around, wrapping one arm in the straps waving from the gurney, and reaching around behind Esme. Her arm wasn't long enough. She tapped Esme's shoulder. If Esme let go with one hand and turned, Brun might be able to reach whatever it was. but she might lose her grip on the gurney. They might not find her. Brun's tap the next time was a solid slug. Esme grinned to herself. Whatever the damage, Brun hadn't changed in some essentials. Carefully, slowly, Esme loosened her grip on the gurney frame on that side and transferred her grip to one of the grab straps on Brun's pea suit. Brun wriggled more. The air gauge quit dropping, stabilized at 8 minutes.
8 minutes. She's got the luck, that one.
Mahari did not say whether 8 minutes would be enough. Esme comforted herself with the knowledge that 1 minute of oxygen deprivation was within anyone's capacity. Brun bumped against her, flinging out an arm and leg.
What is she... Oh.
She was slowing rotation. Esme extended her legs on the other side. The confusing whirl of background slowed as they lay almost crosswise of each other, forming, with the gurney frame, a six-spoked wheel rolling slowly along. Then Brun reached up with her webbing-wrapped arm and pushed up Esme's mirror shield before Esme could bring an arm in to stop her. Her eyes widened. Then she grinned, as mischievous and merry a grin as Esme had ever seen on her face. She used the same arm to work free the thermal-packed bag of IV fluid stick-taped to the gurney, and very deliberately used her glove's screw blade attachment to poke a hole in it. Then she winked at Esme, looking past her, moved the bag around, and squeezed. A stream of saline jetted out, instantly converted to a spray of ice crystals that glittered in the sun. Esme wondered if Brun had just gone completely insane. Then she realized what it was. For all the good it would do, Brun was trying to use an IV as reaction mass to get them back to the station faster. Esme did her best to hold still, even as her air ran out, and the hunger for oxygen overtook her, urging her to run, struggle, fight her way out of the dark, choking tunnel that was squeezing the life out of her.
What's her PO2 doing?
Coming up. Caught it in time.
We're gonna need another can of spray over here.
My God, what did they do to them?
It was the horse, I think.
Esme opened her eyes to see unhelmeted faces bent over her. She wanted to ask the logical question, but she would not ask that one.
We're in the shuttle again. Our targets are alive. No wounds taken in the shootout. We lost 2 dead, 8 with minor injuries. The station's pretty much gone, and there's a fight going on upstairs somewhere. And now that you're with us, we don't have to worry about you anymore. But I do have to do a mental status exam.
Esme took a deep breath, and only then realized that she still had something up her nose feeding her oxygen.
I'm fine. What else is going on?
She tried to sit up, but the medic pushed her back.
Not until we're sure of your blood gases. Your suit telemetry said you were out of air for about 2.5 minutes before we got you reconnected, and that's on the edge of the bad zone.
I'm fine.
No, you're not, but you will be when we're done with you.
The medic inserted a syringe into the IV line Esme had not noticed until then, and a soft, gauzy curtain closed between Esme and the rest of the universe. Baron had the uncomfortable honor of observing the whole collapse of the simple, straightforward extrication from the bridge of Jurfalcon. Most of the carnage had already happened by the time Shrike's signal reached them, and his grandmother ordered the rest of the task force to jump in. They popped out less than 30 light seconds from the planet, only 10 from the nearest enemy ship. Jurfalcon's first salvo took it out. The cruiser's massive energy weapons burned through its shields in less than a second.
Not used to facing real firepower.
Captain, Shrike has recovered 1 shuttle. Casualties.
Please, please, let it not be Esme.
Baron clenched his hand on the ring he had bought for her.
Firing solution on 2nd enemy ship. Red for Shrike.
Hold!
Navarino got it.
Navarino's clear shot at the 2nd enemy ship had blown it as cleanly as their own had the first.
3rd target running. Headed for jump point.
That would be the job of Applejack, the cleanup light cruiser. Baron watched Scan intently as the enemy ship headed toward the minefield Applejack had spent the past 6 hours sewing around the jump corridor. Hazel had seen the bulkhead peeling back and felt a moment of complete panic.
Not now.
But someone's gloved hand caught the bar at the end of her gurney and wrapped a quick line to it, then secured the line to a stick patch. But when she looked, She could see a tumbling, receding shape that had to be Brunn and someone holding her.
Are you all right?
Yes, but what about Brunn?
We'll get them back, don't you worry. And we'll get you into a shuttle.
Yeah, before this place breaks up completely.
Hazel was passed from one set of hands to another, each carefully attaching her to another set of secured lines before releasing the first, and then finally through the cargo hatch of a shuttle. People moved past her, all busy, all doing something she hoped would rescue Brunn. She had heard of Fleet SAR all her life, but she'd never seen it in action. She had no idea that SAR teams wore black pea suits that looked like space armor from story cubes. She'd expected them to wear bright colors with flashers or something to make them easier to see.
Hey there, can you tell us your name again?
That was a blonde woman with sleepy green eyes.
Hazel Takaris, of the Elias Madero.
Her throat closed on all the things she had meant to say, that she'd rehearsed in her head so many times.
We're going after Brunn now. There's a beacon on the officer with her. We can't lose her.
Hazel felt better, but she could sense more tension in the people around her. Something was still wrong.
What is it?
Nothing to worry about. Only this was supposed to be a quick, simple extrication, and we didn't know about you.
I'm sorry.
Don't you be sorry. It's those idiots who planned it who need to be sorry.
The woman looked aside suddenly, and Hazel turned her head to see what it was. The cargo hatch gaped again, and three more black-suited figures swam in, pushing another attached to Brunn's gurney.
Hatch closed. Air up! Air up!
Patch it into the suit, damn it!
Hazel could just see Brunn's turquoise suit. Surely she had air from the suit tanks. The others cut off her view.
Air pressure's numb.
Then they moved, coming past her with the black-suited figure. Two of them stripped off suit gloves and opened the other's black suit with some tool, and it flipped back like a beetle's carapace. Hazel stared. It was space armor. Inside, a limp figure. She could see a pale face, slack-mouthed. Busy arms, hands, and then someone tapped her shoulder.
You don't want to watch it. Gets messy. And since they're working on her, they asked me to do an initial assessment on you. Any trouble breathing?
No, but...
You want to open your helmet? We can talk off the comms that way. Save interference.
Hazel realized she could reach up and open her faceplate. The woman had opened hers as well and was folding back her gloves.
You got any broken bones you know of?
No. Is Brunn all right?
She's fine. She's got her own team working on her.
But who was that?
Lieutenant Suiza. Just a little hypoxia. Don't fret.
She wished people would quit telling her not to worry. She glared at the green-eyed woman.
I'm not a child, you know?
You sure look like one.
Well, I'm...
She wasn't even sure how old she was, or how long she had been a captive. At least a year, because Brunn had those babies.
I'm 17.
Huh? Well, I'm 38, and my name is Methlin Meharry. Want to tell me how you got away?
I was coming back from market.
Hazel had gotten as far as cutting off her hair with the long knives when she heard a bustle of activity from the people working on the officer, on Lieutenant Suiza.
She coming around?
Any minute now.
One of the others came over to Hazel.
All right, let us professionals at her. Let's get you out of that pea suit and see what shape you're in. You be gentle now. You should talk, considering your rep.
I could get out of this myself.
But the medic reached through the sleeves to unfasten her pea suit.
Yes, but we want you in the tent in case the shuttle has pressure problems. Unlikely, but it's a zoo out there.
The medic peeled back her pressure suit section by section.
My God, what did they do to them?
I think it was the horses. We rode horses all night.
Horses? We send a task force halfway across the cluster and they're getting you out on horses?
It makes you really sore. And the clothes were stiff.
Oh, barbarians. Should have spaced the whole bunch.
Shrike scooped up the shuttle, and medics moved Hazel and Brunn into the spacious sick bay. The green-coated medic peeled away the gurney's tent and draped a gown over her.
Regen for you. You'll feel a lot better after an hour or two in the tank.
Hazel wasn't about to argue. She saw that Brunn was being led to the other tank. She settled into the warm, soothing liquid and dozed off. Brunn was furious. They were talking over her head again as if she weren't there, and no one had thought to get her a voice synthesizer. 3 hours aboard, and they continued to treat her like an idiot child.
She'll need another 5 hours of regen for those abrasions, and I still think we should order a parasite scan.
Brunn reached out, caught hold of his uniform, and yanked hard. He staggered, then turned.
Are you all right?
all right?
Brunn shook her head and mimed writing a message.
Oh, you want to say something?
Yes, she wanted to say something. Something very firm. Instead, she smiled and nodded and mimed writing again. Finally, someone handed her a pad. How's Esme? She wrote.
Lieutenant Sweeza is fine. Don't worry. You won't have to see her again. It was strictly against orders.
What?
I want to see her.
That's not a good idea. You weren't supposed to see her at all. We understand how traumatic it was.
Brunn underlined the words, I want to see her, and shoved the pad back at him.
But it was all a mistake.
Saving my life was a mistake.
That came out in a scrawl he had to struggle to read.
No. Her being involved. Your father said under no circumstances should you have to see her after what she said about you.
Carefully calm, she printed her message. I don't care what my father said. Esme saved my life. I want to see her. Now.
But you can't. You need more time in region. And besides, what will the captain say?
Brunn erupted from the bed, ignoring the remaining twinges and slapping aside the tentative grab of the medic. Another medic picked up the injector of sedative spray. With a kick she had practiced in secret for months, she smashed it from his hand. It dribbled down the bulkhead. She pointed a minatory finger at the medics, picked up the pad, and tapped the word, now.
Good to see you up.
Brunn poised to attack, then realized it was Methlin Mahari, whose expression didn't vary as she took in the two medics, the smashed injector, and Brunn, with the short hospital gown flapping about her thighs.
Giving you a hard time, were they? All right, boys, out.
The medics looked at each other and Mahari, and wisely chose withdrawal. Brunn held out the pad.
You want to see Sweeza? Why? I thought she trashed you at Copper Mountain, upset you so you ran away from home.
Brunn shrugged and tapped the pad again.
Yeah, well, she did save your life. And you saved hers, I guess. Or helped. Your father thought seeing her would be a terrible trauma. If it's not, well, it's your decision. You might want to put on some clothes, though. Unless you want her to come down here.
Brunn didn't. She was more than ready to get out of sickbay. Resourceful as ever, Mahari quickly found Brunn a ship suit that almost fit. It wasn't quite as soft as the ship suits Hazel had found on the station, but it fitted her better. Mahari led her through a maze of corridors to a door that had Lieutenant E. Sweeza, Executive Officer, on it.
Now, it's customary to make a courtesy call on the captain. Since the captain told the lieutenant not to let you know she was there, and she did, this could be a bit tricky. Just so you know.
Come in.
When Mahari opened the door, Esme was half sitting on her bunk. She looked pale and tired.
Brunn wants to see you. She kind of insisted when the medics wanted to sedate her.
Brunn moved past Mahari and held out the pad on which she'd already scribbled, thank you. Esme stared at it, then at Brunn, brow furrowed.
They don't have a speaker device for you? What are they thinking of?
They're worried about my stability.
They ought to be worried about your voice, damn it. This is ridiculous. That should be the first thing.
Thank you. My father gave you trouble.
They got the tape of what I said to you that night. And I'm sorry. It really was insulting.
You were right.
No. I was angry, that's what. I thought you were stealing Baron, as if he were my property, which is disgusting of me, but that's how I felt.
You love Baron?
That was something that hadn't occurred to her, even in the months of captivity.
Yes. And you had so much more time, and when I was working, I knew you were spending time with him.
Talking about you?
I didn't know that. Anyway, I said I'm sorry, but they thought I had something against you and your family. Your father didn't want me involved in the planning or with the mission, but that's not the important thing. The important thing is you getting a voice.
Esme thought for a moment.
Mahari.
Mahari knew everyone and everything, as near as Esme could tell. If that device on the station had survived, Mahari would know where it was. And if it hadn't, she'd know what would work. 10 minutes later, a young pivot, so new he squeaked, delivered a briefcase-sized box that flipped open to reveal a keyboard of pre-programmed speech tags, as well as direct input.
Here, try this.
Brunn peered at it and began tapping the buttons.
It looks like the one Lady Cecilia used on Rotterdam.
Let's see what this one sounds like.
I didn't like that one. Let's try this.
Brunn shrugged.
I'll keep this one.
I wonder why they didn't do this first. If they had a synthesizer aboard, why not give it to you right away?
Arrogance. They knew what I needed. Why ask me?
Brunn, I'm so sorry.
Don't waste time. Thank you. You saved my life.
Esme struggled to think how to answer that one.
And by the way, who's doing your hair? It looks good even after being squashed in a suit.
Sarah Sines, Marta Sines, took me to this place, Afino's.
Rafaela's Aunt Marta. You must have impressed her if she took you there. Good for you.
You're good with that thing.
Practice with Cecilia. And you cannot know how good it feels. Now, what's going on with Fleet and the planet? Hazel wants to get the other kids out.
And your babies. Your father's adamant about that. He's not leaving his grandchildren there.
He can have them.
Brunn's expression dared Esme to question that.
Look, I don't know what the whole situation is, because since I'm in disgrace for letting you know I was here, they won't tell me. You're on a search and rescue ship. There's a task force with us. But what we're doing is micro-jumping around, keeping out of the way the militia warships.
Who can I talk to? Who's giving the orders?
On this ship, Captain Solis. For the task force, Admiral Serrano.
Good. I need to talk to her.
Admiral Serrano?
Esme remembered in time that Brunn already knew the Admiral. She might in fact listen.
I can get you as far as Captain Solis, but there's a blackout on communications with the task force.
Captain Solis first.
Esme nodded and led the way without another word. Brunn glanced at Esme. Besides the more effective haircut, there was something else different. She realized, as Esme led her through the ship, and she saw others defer to her, that Esme might indeed be in disgrace, but she was far more than Brunn had imagined. Her own idiocy struck her again, the way she had condescended to this woman, the way she had assumed that Esme was no more than any other student, no more than, for instance, herself. That man in the combat veterans bar had been right. She had not understood at all. They paused at a cross corridor while what looked to Brunn like huge people in armor moved past.
You feeling better, Lieutenant?
Fine, thanks.
Esme turned to Brunn.
They were on the team that got you out.
Thank you.
Brunn hit the controls to save that phrase. She was going to need it a lot. Captain Solis stood as Brunn came in and reached to shake her hand.
We're so glad to have you back.
I'm glad to be back.
Your father did not want you bothered by Lieutenant Suiza, but I understand that you wanted to see her.
Yes, I wanted to apologize to her for my behavior on Copper Mountain. It was made clear to me during my captivity just how badly I had misjudged her. And I wanted to express my profound gratitude for her efforts on my behalf.
You don't know most of it. She is the one who insisted that you were probably still alive after your escape shuttle blew up, that you could have engineered that as a decoy and said we had to go find you. I could almost change my mind.
He spared Esme a glance that Brunn could tell was more approving than usual.
I changed mine.
Well, now that we've got you and the other Hazel Takaris, is that her name? We can jump safely back to the task force and get out of here with no more disruption.
No.
Captain Solis jumped. Brunn bit back a grin. It would not do to laugh at the man.
But what?
We must get the other children from the ship Hazel was on.
I don't see how.
We must.
But Hazel said they were safe, that they had adjusted to their new family.
We cannot leave little girls, Familia citizens by birth, to be brought up in a society where they can be muted like me for saying the wrong thing.
You're naturally overwrought.
I am tired, sore, hungry, and extremely tired of having no voice. But I am not overwrought. Those children were stolen from their families. Their parents were murdered horribly. and they're in the control of people who were willing to kidnap, rape, and abuse me. How dare you suggest that they are safe enough where they are?
Sarah, it's not my decision. It will be the Admiral's, if she can make it without authorization from the Grand Council, which I doubt.
Then I will see the Admiral.
It will be some time before we can rendezvous safely.
Solas gave Esme a long look.
And for the time being, Lieutenant, could you find quarters for our guest? I know we're crowded with extra crew, not to mention prisoners.
Yes, sir.
Prisoners.
Two groups. Three different shuttle loads came up to the station after you. One blew itself up, but we caught two.
Brunn wanted to see them. She wanted to let them see her, free and healthy, and... No, she would get her voice back first, and then she would see them.
Something to eat?
Right away.
Esme led her to the wardroom. Brunn sat reveling in food which someone else had cooked. Flavors she was used to, condiments she liked, anything she chose to drink, while watching Esme covertly.
What did Afinos do to her hair? And for that matter, what can I do about my hair after hacking it off so blindly with a knife?
Several days later, with her hair once more a riot of tousled curls, thanks to the crew's barber, she was ready to tackle Admiral Serrano.
You are coming with me. I need you. I trust you.
You could take Meharry.
But she is not you. I need you.
I'm the executive officer. I can't just leave the ship.
Then the Admiral can come here. Which do you think she'd like least?
Put like that, there was no question. Esme tracked down Captain Solas and received permission to accompany Brunn to the flagship.
And it has not escaped my notice that almost 2 years without a voice has not begun to stop that young woman giving orders. We had better get her commissioned, so at least it's legal.